You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. We're your hosts for the show. We got a really big program planned for you this evening.
Our show will start off with an interview with Saratoga author Jeff Goodall about his new book on climate change, The Water Will Come.
We will then have a live interview with Rich Ring about the issue of immigration and the efforts to make Troy a sanctuary city.
Following that will be a segment by Jim Welch with Connor Valley on his efforts to establish a community-supported agriculture farm here in the city of Troy.
We finish with WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press interviewing Troy resident artist and maker Rob Lee McIntyre to discuss the high percentage of women-owned businesses in downtown Troy.
And now the news headlines. United States Representative John Faso said in a telephone town hall Tuesday evening that he remains undecided about how he'll vote on Republican tax overhaul legislation, with the House expected to take up its version tomorrow. New York State officials are upset by plans to curtail the deductions of state and local taxes, which will result in a huge federal tax hike for New York State residents. Faso noted during the call that the standard deduction would be doubled to $24,000 for married couples. Faso also said he does not support eliminating the Affordable Care Act individual mandate as part of a tax overhaul plan, as the Senate is proposing. However, Faso does not support the mandate.
Finally, after 2 days of counting absentee ballots, Republican Assemblyman Steve McLaughlin emerged as the victor in the race for Rensselaer County Executive over Andrea Smith. Carmelo Mantalo prevailed over Gary Pavlik for Troy City Council President. Democrats now have a 5-2 majority on the City Council.
Zimbabwe's military took control of the county and detained its longtime leader, President Robert Mugabe, earlier Wednesday, capping a political showdown over Mugabe's apparent attempts to install his wife as successor. Mugabe, 93 and increasingly frail, has ruled since he led the country to independence from white minority rule in 1980. Mugabe supporters hail him for moves such as dismantling white-owned estates and other holdings. Yet he is also reviled as a dictator who brutally crushed dissent and allowed the once prosperous country to sink into a cycle of deepening poverty.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions suggesting that he may appoint a special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton has alarmed current and former Justice Department officials who fear he will politicize the embattled agency. Sessions told Congress today that after being pressured by President Trump, he will weigh recommendations from senior prosecutors on whether to appoint a special counsel over a 2010 uranium company deal and other issues, including donations to the Clinton Foundation.
15,000 of the world's scientists have just issued a second warning that humanity's action threatens the very existence of human beings. Since 1992, when the first warning was issued, with the exception of stabilizing the stratospheric ozone layer, humanity has, in quotes, failed to make sufficient progress in solving environmental challenges, and alarmingly, most of them are getting far worse. The scientists are especially troubled by the current trajectory of potentially catastrophic climate change from burning fossil fuels, deforestation, and agriculture production. Climate change has also unleashed a mass extinction event. Many current life forms could be annihilated or near extinction by the end of this century.
Six House Democrats on Wednesday introduced 5 new articles of impeachment against President Trump, saying that he is in danger to the country, among other charges, the lawmakers say Trump obstructed justice when he fired former FBI Director James Comey, who was leading an investigation into possible election tampering by Russia. That included questions of potential collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign team. The Congress members also accusing Trump of violating the Foreign Enrollment Clause, which bars public officials from receiving gifts from foreign governments without Congress's consent, and the Domestic Enrollment Clause, which bars the president from profiting from his office. Other Congress members are planning to file additional impeachment articles.
More than 60% of Australians have voted in a non-binding referendum in support of legalizing same-sex marriage. With more than three-quarters of eligible voters participating, the nation's political leaders have pledged to implement the results. Two dozen countries have now legalized same-sex marriage.
That's it for the headlines.
Our first segment is with Jeff Goodall, a Saratoga author who is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. He has written a new book on climate change with a particular focus on the impact of rising sea levels. As we speak, world leaders are meeting in Germany to discuss next steps on climate change. Jeff Goodall is a writer from Saratoga and a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. He is out with his fifth book, The Water Will Come, about climate change and the impact of rising tides. Jeff, what prompted you to write this new book?
Well, I'd been covering climate change for a long time, 15 years or so, and knew about the problems of sea level rise in the abstract, but it was really going down to New York the day after Hurricane Sandy hit and seeing the devastation that Sandy caused in Lower Manhattan. As a journalist, I was thinking about ways to try to write about it, and I talked to a scientist at Columbia who said to me, well, one way to think about what happened in Lower Manhattan is to imagine that sort of 9-foot surge of water that came in, which is about the sort of high end of sea level rise predictions for the end of the century. Imagine that water came in and never went out. And that was quite a profound idea to me. And so I did imagine that. I went to Miami, and I ended up traveling all over the world and looking at the implications of rising water.
Well, you mentioned 9-foot level of sea surge in New York City. And I think the prediction for quite a while had been scientists talking about, you know, maybe another 3-foot of sea level rise over, you know, by the end of the century. But pretty much all the predictions that scientists have had in terms of the impact of climate change or the level of climate change have been understated. What are we now actually predicting in terms of respect to how high the sea levels will rise?
Well, the latest predictions from NOAA, which is the top science agency in the U.S., and hardly a kind of alarmist agency, they have the high end at 7 feet now. That's sort of in the latest climate assessment that just came out a few weeks ago, the National Climate Assessment actually says it could go as high as 8 feet. So
8 feet by the end of this century.
Yeah, and of course it won't stop then. It will continue. It is not something that ends at the turn of the century.
Now, two of the most threatened cities on the planet from climate change are two that you've already mentioned, Miami and New York City. Spent some time in both of them. How are they already experiencing the impact of climate change? And, is each one of those cities really doing enough at this point to deal with the rise in seas?
Nobody's doing enough, certainly not Miami or New York. New York has made a lot of improvements since Hurricane Sandy, but, still the task is monumental when you consider the size and scale of the city. In Miami, you already see problems. One of the reasons I ended up really plunging into this book was after Hurricane Sandy. I went down to Miami and was wandering around Miami Beach at King Tides, which are the sort of fall high tides, the highest tides of the year. And, I was up to my knees in water in one of the sort of wealthiest neighborhoods in Miami Beach, and just from the surging tides. So, I mean, it's already a real problem down there. It's a real problem in New York, in places that are low-lying areas that are flooding, like areas around Jamaica Bay, South Brooklyn, Queens, around there. And, of course, every bit of rising water makes the next hurricane or the next big storm surge all the more damaging, because all of this, you know, rising water is on top. It just adds to the storm surge eventually.
Now, of course, in Florida, we had a governor telling, you know, state, you know, workers, do not mention the word climate change. And I always had thought that, you know, one of the ways the United States would begin to take climate change seriously when a major city, and I was thinking Orlando or Tampa, got hit and was not able to get it back up and recover, you know, from that hit. And, of course, the Florida did get hit. It veered off, so it wasn't quite as impactful. Unfortunately, Puerto Rico got a direct hit, and they're not getting back up after any time. But how in Florida has, if you're aware, how has the recent hurricane sort of changed some of the dialogue about climate change in the state?
Well, I mean, it's a slow change. I mean, you know, there is always this idea out there that, you know, when a significant event happens, that will sort of transform people's minds and they will sort of suddenly get it, you know. But, I mean, I think that was pretty well disproven after Katrina wiped out New Orleans, and it wasn't like there was a transformation in people's thinking about the risks of climate change. I do think that it makes incremental changes, and people are beginning to see not just these storms, but the wildfires in the West and the strange hot summers and, you know, the accumulation of scientific evidence, which is so overwhelming. I mean, I think it's beginning to, change. You know, a lot of people are beginning to grasp what's really kind of going on. I think the real holdout for denialism is in Congress. I think that you know, you have so much fossil fuel money going to our representatives in Congress that they won't budge on this. And until they budge, it's really hard to make progress on some of the big kind of initiatives that need to happen in order to really deal with cutting carbon emissions.
We're talking with Jeff Goodall, who is the author of The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and The Remaking of the Civilized World. Now, WOOC, we literally broadcast about 100 yards from the start of the old historic Erie Canal and right along the Hudson River. Troy, of course, is at the end, at least in terms of the dam, of a tidal river, the Hudson River. How, you know, does rising sea levels threaten the future, say, of a place like Troy on a tidal river?
Well, I mean, everywhere is, it will certainly lift the waters, even in places like Troy and make the tide higher there, although it's far enough away that it will be, you know, incremental. Certainly the places that are closest to the ocean and low-lying places close to the ocean, like parts of Brooklyn and Queens and the Rockaways and the Jersey Shore, parts of Long Island, are really where the sort of biggest risks are.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the world nations are actually meeting this week in Germany to follow up on the recent climate agreement in Paris. It's pretty well accepted that the actual commitments that the countries have made to curb emissions are nowhere near the level to keep global warming below the catastrophic tipping point. And do you hold much hope that the world's governments will ever get their act together to save humanity from climate change?
That's the big question. And if you'd have asked me this a year ago, I was in Paris when the Paris Agreement was made. And, you know, as most people know, that was a moment when all the nations of the world kind of came together. And even though the commitments weren't enough to really, cut emissions enough to reduce the risk of dangerous climate change, there was a big start. It was like the first time everyone had agreed to a framework and to kind of pressing forward on this. And I felt very, very hopeful that day and in the aftermath of that. But, of course, now everything has changed. We have a president who's doing everything he can to promote the use of fossil fuels, who's, you know, pulled out of the Paris Agreement, who is doing everything he can to to kind of, you know, throw a monkey wrench in all of this. And we're seeing, you know, the results. You know, the international efforts are kind of stalled. We just got reports yesterday that CO2 emissions globally have climbed again for the first time in 3 years. You know, it's hard to be hopeful about that. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book about sea level rise, because I think in addition to working hard to cut emissions, we have to start working hard to think about how we're going to adapt, because it's pretty clear that we're going to see big changes in the coming decades, and we need to think about how we're going to deal with those.
Well, speaking of, well, I don't know if adaptation is the exact word here, but your last chapter, as well as the theme of one of your prior books, raises the issue of geoengineering. What is geoengineering for our listeners, and what role, if any, do you see that it will play in a role to try to deal with climate change?
Well, geoengineering refers to a range of different kind of technologies that can be used to either kind of pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, essentially artificial trees, or the kind that is sort of more dangerous and more frankly likely to be deployed is essentially creating artificial volcanoes. It's well known that when a big volcano erupts like Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines did, it sprays particles up into the stratosphere, and those particles act as little reflectors and reflect away sunlight. And after Mount Pinatubo, the temperature of the Earth actually was lowered by more than a degree. So there's some scientists who have been advancing the idea that, you know, if climate change gets really kind of out of hand, we might be able to artificially kind of inject sulfate particles into the atmosphere to cool things off. It works like just like a kind of parasol does to block out sun. And you wouldn't have to put that much up there to have, to reflect away 1% or 2% of the sunlight would be all you would need to do. I'm not advocating this. I don't think it's a good idea. There's lots of reasons why we shouldn't do this, including acidification of the oceans and lots of other things, and I would encourage you to look at that chapter of my book. But I think we're going to get to a point where there's going to be a demand for a quick fix, and this is a not a good fix, but it could easily be played as a quick fix for climate change.
Yeah, I've always assumed that, you know, at some point in the next 30 to 50 years, we'll end up having the biggest corporate welfare boondoggle on the planet as we throw more and more money at sequestration of coal, geoengineering, you know, things that people can make a lot of money off without any type of proven track record. But in writing the book, you know, were the things that you discovered about climate change and about rising tides that, you know, both surprised you, but would, you know, also be very surprising, you know, to the average listener?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is that a lot of people think of sea level rise as something that's, you know, this happens in this slow, incremental way. You know, you go to the beach and you stand at the beach for 2 weeks and you stare at the water and you don't see anything changing, you know. So it's hard for us to compute in kind of real time the risks and the consequences of this. But one of the things that I learned reporting the book is that in the past, sea level rise has happened in pulses, you know, that there's been kind of dramatic moments, dramatic melts, and in times in the past, it's risen as much as 13 feet in a single century. And that kind of thing is certainly possible, and a lot of scientists are concerned about that because of the instability, and especially West Antarctica right now, and the possibility of these big ice cliffs there collapsing into the sea. So that's one thing. The other thing that I learned that's really important, I thought, was that you don't need a whole lot of rising seas to have big consequences, economic consequences for coastal cities and coastal areas. Even 6 inches of increased sea level rise will have big impacts on beach erosion, on coastal homes, on roads, on all kinds of infrastructure. And that begins to cost coastal communities a lot of money, and the sort of economics of it get really ugly for coastal areas. And you start adding in decline in real estate values and things, and it's really a kind of economic nightmare for a lot of the areas.
So just sort of to finish up, any little information out here to get your book, and particularly, do you plan any you know, book readings or talks here in the Capital District that our listeners might be able to attend?
I have an event at Skidmore in March. I did events in Saratoga last few weeks ago and in Manchester, Vermont. So my next event, it will be at Skidmore. And I encourage everyone to come to that.
Okay, so we've been talking with Jeff Goodall, and this is the Water Will Come, Rise and Seed, Sink in Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. And this has been Mark Dunlight.
That was Jeff Goodall, a Saratoga resident, discussing his new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of Civilized World. Next, we have in studio Rich Ring of the Ice-Free Capital District Sanctuary. Thanks so much, Rick, for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rich, I understand there's an effort to declare Troy a sanctuary city to help provide some protection to non-documented immigrants from being deported. Can you explain, I guess, both what a sanctuary city is, but also the new sanctuary movement?
Sure. Well, yes. The new sanctuary movement, as it's called, has been in existence for quite a while, as have the idea of sanctuary cities. And it's called New Sanctuary because it's essentially in the spirit of the sanctuary movement that emerged in the 80s, assisting refugees from Latin America fleeing U.S.-sponsored wars there. But at any rate, this new sanctuary movement has a number of fronts in which it attempts to assist immigrants, particularly undocumented immigrants. Sanctuary cities is just one of them. There's no legal definition of sanctuary city, and a lot of people are confused about what it is. But I guess I could start by saying what a sanctuary city isn't, because there's a lot of misinformation out there, and there's a lot of deliberate misinformation being used to discourage sanctuary cities. But the idea of a sanctuary city is not to, it doesn't change anyone's immigration status. It doesn't prevent anyone from being arrested for a crime. What it does do is prevent sort of an unfunded mandate of making local law enforcement officials and other government officials do the federal government's job.
So what type of interest is generated to make a city a sanctuary city? You know,
right. Well, the sanctuary city movement. Did everybody get that? The sanctuary city movement has been growing for a while, and of course, in response to Trump's election, there was a great deal of renewed interest because his xenophobia and racism, frankly, during the election and scapegoating immigrants for the nation's problems was repellent to so many people, and that triggered a great deal of support in response for the vital role that immigrants play in our country. So in upstate New York, there was a sort of a real flush of success in cities becoming sanctuary cities. And that's not, as I said, a legal term, but in passing resolutions in support of immigrants and against cooperating unnecessarily with ICE, which is Immigration Customs Enforcement. So the city of Kingston, the city of Syracuse, the city of Rochester, and closer to home, the city of Albany, near the end of last year, just about this time last year, passed a resolution in support of immigrants and has since laid down rules and legislation preventing city government officials and law enforcement officials from cooperating with ICE, except under certain conditions.
Now, I understand that the city of Troy has not yet rushed to embrace its future as a sanctuary city. But of course, we now have had a new election and a new city council is coming in, and apparently some of those members are much more open and supportive of this issue. So can maybe give us an overview of how have things gone here in the city in terms of trying to approach the sanctuary city status and where you hope next steps will be?
Sure, sure. So the Troy New Sanctuary movement and the effort to make Troy Sanctuary City is very new. Our first meeting was this past January, and it grew very quickly, and it found a lot of support. And among its supporters were a number of downtown congregations and churches, the Troy area Labor Council was an early endorser. We have a petition drive that got a lot of signatures very rapidly. And we brought a large crowd to the Troy City Council meeting last June. It was standing room only in that meeting.
So, Jeff, what does local law enforcement have to do with, you know, establishing a sanctuary city? I noticed when Albany went through that whole process and it was, you know, the district attorney got involved and the local police, and there was all kinds of citations and stuff. So tell me, you know, what does that do and how does that process work?
Right. Well, essentially, as I said, the idea of a sanctuary city is that local law enforcement would have nothing to do with people's immigration status and enforcing those laws, because those are federal laws. They're not local laws and they're not state laws. And so, you know, what happens, and local law enforcement officials aren't trained to do that, and that's not their job. Their job is to keep people safe. Mm-hmm. So in situations where local law enforcement has gotten involved with ICE and tried to enforce federal immigration law, it's created a lot of problems. Racial profiling, profiling of immigrants in general, incorrect arrests and detainment of people, of immigrants and other people who aren't immigrants because of racial profiling, because you're asking local law enforcement to do essentially this unfunded mandate and do the federal government's job for it.
Now, I'll confess I spent the last, you know, 7 years before returning to the Capital District living in Brooklyn. And it's an amazing percentage of residents of New York City who were born outside the United States. It's almost like majority or even larger. And so, of course, we're very supportive of the immigrant community down there because they're your neighbor. They're the person that takes care of you. They do work for you. They're at the supermarket. They're doing the construction. They're doing everything. So in Troy, you know, who are the people who would be opposed to trying to protect? I mean, after all, we're a nation of immigrants. Unless you're Native American, everybody here came from someplace else, and probably within two or three generations in many cases.
Absolutely. And, you know, the word that I keyed in on when you said, you know, that people were very supportive of immigrants there because they're your neighbor. Well, it's exactly the same here in Troy. They're your neighbors here, too. Who are immigrants? Well, you can't describe who undocumented immigrants are all under one brush easily. There's 12 million, some people say, in the United States or more. But they are our neighbors. They are our employees, employers, small business owners. Their children go to school with citizens' children, and they're here in the community. Now, it is true that in the past year, under a lot of the racist rhetoric and xenophobia that was spread during the Trump campaign, it's caused a lot of folks, of undocumented folks, to feel more afraid to go outside. They're afraid of enforcement, of being accosted, of being asked on the street, where are their papers? But as you say, who these people are, they're our neighbors, and they're part of our community. And we don't want to see any of them go. And that's ICE-Free's commitment. ICE-Free, we want Immigrations and Customs Enforcement out of the Capital District because we need all our neighbors.
Okay, so where do you see this movement 3 years from now?
Well, as mentioned, there's been a big change in Troy City Council government. Several of the new elected Troy City Council members have been supportive of our movement and supportive of the idea of making Troy a sanctuary city. So in a few years, I see Troy as a sanctuary city, for starters. But also, our work here at Troy New Sanctuary is not just that protection, which is essentially keeping a status quo to a certain extent and saying we need our neighbors here and we don't want Troy to start an unfunded mandate that we can't afford in Troy, but also working directly with immigrants and helping folks to be more integrated into the community, provide undocumented immigrants with services that they need, and essentially, yeah, get to know our neighbors is sort of part of our focus going forward.
Now, I've been getting a lot of emails in my inbox the last few weeks about you know, need to talk to the sheriff about his relationship with ICE and something about a 287G program. Can you explain what's going on at the county level, and particularly with the sheriff, and maybe even a little bit about sheriff's independent of the county executive? We just elected a new county executive.
Right. Well, yes, the beautifully named 287G agreement is essentially a memorandum of understanding between a law enforcement agency, in this case the sheriff's office, and ICE. So again, what this is an agreement that local law enforcement will begin doing the job of the federal government. And who would pay for that? Well, the taxpayers of Rensselaer County would pay for that. So if you're a fiscal conservative, you should very much be opposed to this 287G agreement.
I thought every county official in Rensselaer County hated unfunded mandates. That was the worst thing that could possibly happen, is an unfunded mandate.
Well, that's right. And I think a lot of counties take a look at this proposal, this proposed 287G agreement from the federal government, and once they're in it, they realize that it's going to cost them a lot of money, and a number of counties have backed out after starting. Now, Albany County initially filed an application to be part of the 287G agreement, and Sheriff Apple in Albany County recently withdrew that application. And just today, the New York Civil Liberties Union met with the Rensselaer County Sheriff's Department and asked them to do the same thing, to get rid of this agreement. Now, it is an unfunded mandate and a waste of Rensselaer County taxpayers' money. But that's certainly not the only reason it's a bad idea. It's a bad idea because it leads to racial profiling, and this has been demonstrated in study after study. And as well, it decreases trust between the immigrant communities and local law enforcement. And of course, you know, if there is a fire, if there is an altercation and local law enforcement is needed for some reason, there needs to be some level of trust between the immigrant community and law enforcement.
So what I see sometimes from people who walk in the streets throughout the city is they see sanctuary cities as taking their jobs away. You know, all right, they live here, they work here. Like, I see the guy standing out there on the corner that's literally staring poverty in the face, and he says, well, here comes another person into my town, and they're going to get all the benefits and all the grants and all the helps, and 2 years from now, they'll be running a store at a corner bodega, and I have nothing. What do you say to that? How do you speak to that?
Well, I guess a couple issues on that. One is that immigrants benefit the community, and study after study from an economic perspective have showed that increased immigration to an area increases economic growth, contrary to a lot of misinformation that's been put out there. They improve the tax base. Even undocumented immigrants who can't receive a tax refund are paying in via Social Security numbers or IDIN numbers. You know, and as was pointed out earlier, this city and most of the country was built from immigrants who came here and did the same thing.
So I think we have about 4 minutes or so left. You know, one question is, I know that, you know, the Trump administration has been threatening cities that are sanctuary cities with a loss of federal funding. How does that whole, you know, antagonistic approach by the Trump administration towards cities that are trying to be a little bit more welcome to immigrants, how does that stand, and how is that threat to take away money actually held up?
Well, I think it's fear-mongering. It's fear-mongering, and it's attempting to turn us against each other. And by us, I mean, I guess for a simple phrase, sort of the 99%. It's scapegoating immigrants. And it's also, like a lot of his threats, an empty threat. The president doesn't have the power to issue a proclamation and say, we're cutting off funding to sanctuary cities. First of all, as I said, there's no legal definition of sanctuary cities. I'm not sure which cities he has in mind or where people are that he doesn't like. Apparently, a lot of us. But only Congress would have that power, number one. And number two, essentially, it's not just sanctuary cities. Under the current policies, they're threatening to cut funding, and they're attacking working people all over the country. And what we need to do is unite with each other, whether or not we're documented, and fight these cuts.
So what can people do?
Thank you for asking. There are a number of things, sort of looking ahead locally and further afield. If you're interested in the issue, I really would encourage people to check out the Facebook page of our local group, Ice Free Capital District. Look us up on Facebook. If you go there, you can also find a link, and we'll be changing this in the next few days, but a link to our for our Troy Sanctuary City petition. You can sign the petition. If you're interested in providing direct aid to immigrants, the new sanctuary in Albany does provide direct aid to immigrants, and especially the undocumented who do not have access to other resources. And they can be contacted at Emmaus House, 45 Trinity Place, Albany, New York. That's 12202. And they provide a lot of direct aid with housing, school supplies, etc., and are always in need of donations.
Well, we've been talking to Rich Ring of the ICE Free Capital District and New Sanctuary. So, Rich, we want to thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those just tuning in, I'm H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
Next, we hear an interview by WOOC correspondent Jim Welch with Connor Valley about his efforts to establish a community supported by agriculture, farm, and Troy.
I like to call myself an urban farmer. I have my urban farm located in South Troy, Little Italy, and I've been pursuing to grow food for my local community and myself, and have been doing it for about 3 years now.
How big a property are you working on there?
About 2,600 square feet.
So that's like a single Troy City lot?
Yep.
All right. But I gather you're looking to step up your game. I see some fancy literature here, which I gather is new. Do you want to talk about what you've got in store coming up?
Yeah, I'm looking to just do a community supported agriculture. I've done it for a few years now, but as the years go on, I'm building more infrastructure and more closed loop systems that produce food more efficiently.
You're farming in an urban setting. Most people do agriculture in rural settings. Can you say why you've chosen to do it urban farming as opposed to out in the country?
To me, it's kind of a new frontier. It's happening all over the country and all over the world, of course. But it's interesting. There's new ways coming. People are coming up with new ways all the time, and it's a new challenge to do so. Troy is a great biking city. It's one-way streets, and it's, Troy's very long along the Hudson River, so it's easy to move around on a bicycle. So with urban agriculture, bicycles come into play to move produce and compost. And
by doing it in a city, you can have a practice that's light on fossil fuel usage. Is that one of the things that's driving you here?
Yeah, definitely. I think urban farming is very sustainable in the way of producing food. I believe in the future it's very much of a necessity as fossil fuels become more expensive and people have low access to food in urban settings as well.
I would guess you could make the case that it'd be easier to provide fresher food if your customers are just a few blocks away. It's not like you would be making a weekly run, either you to the you know, if you were doing agriculture, you know, 10 miles away in a rural setting, and you wanted to deliver your food to somebody in the city, or if, like a lot of CSAs around here, somebody in the city who was a customer of the CSA drives to the farm to pick up the food once a week, by you having the food basically around the corner from your customers, it's easier for the customers to get the food very fresh. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. Startup costs to do so, it's basically a bicycle, a trailer, and you can pretty much move a lot of stuff. I've tested the limits. Been moving things like mulch and you know, produce, and just been able to do a lot on a bicycle and a trailer. It's a powerful thing. Bike power is important for the future.
Are there some differences you could talk about in terms of farming in the city versus out in the country? Differences in soil, different things you have to do to protect your crop from hazards, that sort of thing.
I actually work on a organic vegetable farm in Scaticoke, and there is a lot of difference. The space is probably the first thing I think of. With the large amount of space, you're able to grow more, and the limited space in an urban setting, you really have to limit what you get to grow, and you really have to be precise on your moves in doing so.
Do you have concerns about the soil? A lot of people would be concerned about lead in the soil. You know, this is a lot. How long ago did you acquire the lot?
3 years ago. Been building soil since. I use poultry building soil with compost. Basically, using a system to increase the health of the soil. As much as there are bad stuff in the soil, it is possible to remedy it in certain ways. Certain crops are probably not as good to use in urban settings. Like I wouldn't plant a head of lettuce or in really bad soil. I would do something more like a tomato, which after, of course, remedying the soil, which is fruit doesn't absorb as much lead as you could say, like garlic would.
It seems to me I've heard that, is it pears or peaches, the boundary between the tree and the peach, I think it's peaches, doesn't permit lead through. Can you confirm that?
I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've done my research, and I'm pretty sure that's the idea, is that anything that fruits does a little bit better than something like, garlic or alliums or something that's grown in the ground.
I was reading about arsenic recently. I'm a fan of using rock dust in soil as a way to add nutrients to the plants, and local rock dust, like from the quarries here in out Route 2, are reputed to have a fair amount of arsenic, naturally occurring arsenic in them. And so I was reading about arsenic, and I sort of got the impression is that if the part of the plant you're eating is the root, that's going to have the most arsenic in it. If the part you're eating is the leaves, that'll have less arsenic than the root of a plant. And then if what you're eating is like a fruit, like a tomato, that would have the least amount, which sort of makes sense. Is that sort of the idea that you have about contaminants in the soil as well?
Yeah, definitely. I do a lot of sheet mulching, which is layering cardboard and then continuing that with straw and mulch and then another layer of cardboard. So you're creating a layer above the contaminated soil. which it after years becomes quite beautiful, actually. The worms, the microorganisms, just you know, instead of disturbing the soil, you're just giving them food, and they move upwards, digesting all of that and turning it into good, rich soil.
And over time, you know, heavy metals are heavy, right? And so the natural tendency is for them to sink. So as you're adding soil, it seems to me they would be unlikely to be moving up. If anything, they'd be moving down.
Right. When cities demolish a house or whatever building that's there, they tend to leave it and cover it with a, you know, thin layer of topsoil that is not very healthy. And I think that it's really good not to disturb that. It's best to grow on top of that. There's other practices such as hygge culture, which is a German practice of using, digging trenches about a couple feet and then filling it with wood, and then on top of that sticks, and then soil on top of that. And as that decomposes, it becomes really rich soil. So it's there's definitely different tactics to remedy soils to make healthy food in urban settings.
So how about people? If you're out in the country, you don't have to worry so much about people trampling your crops or walking through your terrorizing your chickens or anything like that. Is that a concern in the city? Good fences make good neighbors? I don't know.
To be honest, because I have animals, I like to keep a high security, so I have a pretty tall fence protecting them. But for the most part, people are pretty curious. They're interested. They like it. They like to hear the noises. For the most part, not everyone is in favor of chickens or ducks in an urban setting, but I think it's kind of a necessity. They're great digesters of compost, and that helps a lot. But yeah, the city of Troy allows livestock, actually. As I think the rule in the book is, as long as it's not roaming the streets, that it's able to be accepted by the city, although that rule is probably from way back when.
So you're saying, I mean, I'd always heard that we could have chickens but not roosters. You're saying any livestock, a cow, I could have a cow, and the city of Troy doesn't have a law against that?
Well, there's always of course not. I think if someone complains, then you have an issue. Of course, I think someone's going to complain about a cow in a backyard. But places like Albany are not allowed to have chickens, and I think they're fighting to reverse that. But yeah, I'd like to show the city that it can be done. Micro livestock is important. It's important for sustainability, and can create a really good education to show people where their food really comes from.
How can listeners contact you if they want more information about what you're doing?
Anyway, really, I have an Instagram, which is Valley of the Wind, and I have a website, just Valley of the Wind. That's through WordPress. And I'm right around the corner, really. I'm downtown Troy on Adams Street, and yeah. Very local and ready to serve my community in the way of growing good, nutrient-rich food.
That was WOOC correspondent Jim Welch speaking with Troy urban farmer Connor Valley.
WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press met up with Troy resident artist and maker Robert Lee McIntyre to discuss the high percentage of women-owned businesses in downtown Troy, what it takes to have the courage to work on big projects, and Robert Lee's new shop on River Street in Troy called Broccoli.
It's at 282 River. I started out with a studio in the basement, which is now kind of morphed into being upstairs. I teach creativity workshops there. One of the ideas I'd had for that old rectory in North Central that I lived in, the St. Barnabas Rectory, was to open a home ec style school with practical creative classes, you know, sewing and some woodworking and tool use and management, some clay, things like that, some gardening. So I'm doing that on a small scale now in my studio. So some upholstery, I think, going on this month, some ceramics, some I'll be working with air dry clay. I'll be doing photo transfer. I'll be doing some aromatherapy. And then also, I think as a living artist, I like to get paid a fair wage. That's one of the biggest lessons I've gotten in the past 5 years. And so in that, I believe in fair trade. I don't know if I can just make a living off of only my art in Troy. So I like to offer products that are beautifully designed and made, and people all over the world are compensated for making them.
And can you just talk about the landscape just a little bit of being like a woman-owned business in downtown Troy? What's that like?
Yeah, it's really great down there. I think overall very supportive. It's 85% women-owned businesses downtown Troy, many of them being open past a 10-year mark, which is kind of a miracle if you do national statistics and things like that. So I think the fact that it's a vibrant female thriving community is awesome. There's some challenges in terms of shopping, but we're all plugging away, doing a great job. The boutiques, you can't even top them. They're really nice. There's no other downtown doing it any better. And we're all down there with our little bubble of wonderful juice and just kind of bubbling up everything, the food, the bars, the shops. It's fantastic downtown Troy right now.
And at one point, I think you said something about, you know, I just want to talk about why I love it, why I love Troy. Is that what you mean by it?
I think there's just everywhere you go in Troy, at every level, you're going into any neighborhood and you're going to find somebody who's passionate about what they're doing. They're doing something interesting. They're doing something smart. They're doing something that's just hard. Sometimes they're growing food in abandoned lots. They're building condominiums out of a record building. I mean, there's so many interesting people contributing to Troy. It's a melting pot like really no other city I've lived in. And it's a kind city. You can see that by, you could just see it's a kind city. And maybe it's because it's a female city. I don't know. I just love it here. It's great. You've got the woods right here. You got the water. Who else is doing it any better? Nobody.
So when I moved to Troy just a couple years ago, you were working on a project in North Troy, North Central. What's that project all about?
Well, that started because I fell in love with the St. Barnabas Rectory. The St. Barnabas Church next door is still an active church, a Baptist now. And it was a neighborhood that had a lot of boarded up windows, and there was some prostitution going on, and it was dark down there, and it just felt dangerous. And the abandoned buildings, it was an entire block of abandoned buildings, it seemed. So it was the thought that if you buy everything in a 2x2x2 block area, you buy everything. You buy the land that's abandoned, you buy the worst house, you buy the best house, as it comes up, you buy it. And you renovate it affordably, you make comfortable, affordable apartments that are funky, and you rent to people without gentrifying, with an all-inclusive mind. You can have a dog there, and it was right on the river. The hangar became a part of that, which is now being run by Brian Gilchrist at the Ale House, which is great. He's doing a fantastic job. And then in the span of 3 or 4 years, you've got the lights on that used to be off. So it was a super exciting time. We had a blacksmith shop. We were farming. We did some chickens. It was really great. And we impacted that neighborhood quite positively, I have to say that. I decided I had to stop that for a bunch of different reasons. And so I always go back to my art because at heart, I'm a fine artist. Interior design is really fun, and my art always spills into it. But so I work in this shop now. My studio is there, and I sell fair trade and handmade goods from all over.
If there's someone listening to this segment right now that is thinking, oh, I've always wanted to jump off that diving board, I've always wanted to, you know, start a business in downtown Troy, are there any lessons that you've learned that you can think of right now that you would like to share about, you know, things you've tried that have really worked or things that maybe you tried and didn't go just as well as you have planned that you wouldn't want someone to make the same mistakes again?
I find every facet of it super challenging. But that's always, I'm always stretching the boundaries of my comfort zone. So I'm never quite comfortable. And I think that's part of it. You have to be willing, no matter what you do, to do it with passion, for sure. And to feel uncomfortable and a little terrified the whole time. It's a dive off of a cliff. There's so many wonderful things. So many wonderful things, and there's sometimes you get knocked, and I don't know, the trick is just to keep going and to do it. You can't do it from your sofa. You have to get up. You have to believe in your own heart and what you're here for and step forward and do it. Find a way to do it. Keep yourself alive that way.
Now we're running out of time, but is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to add before we close out this segment?
I think people are here and they're buying the old buildings and they're fixing them up, and our city has gotten more inclusive and smarter and chic, and I just am so glad to be here and be a part of it and contribute in the ways that I can contribute, and I'm extra thankful that everybody else is here doing the same kind of thing, contributing in their wonderful ways, and that's it, I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press speaking with Troy entrepreneur Robalee McIntyre. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Once again, I'm Mark Dunley, and we're going to have a great show tomorrow evening. We'll have an update on the Dak Meek McDonald shooting involving the Troy police. We'll have an interview with Parvez Sharman, a filmmaker, will be here at the Sanctuary on Saturday night talking his film is Sinner in Mecca, about his travels as a gay person to visit that city. And in the youth team, we'll have a segment interviewing a teenage refugee from Afghan. And I understand, Bosch, you got something tomorrow.
Yes, I have and have the pleasure of interviewing tomorrow Kizzy Williams, owner and entrepreneur of Ali B's Restaurant and Catering, Albany, New York. I'm really, really looking forward to that interview. To learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, please visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. And if you'd like the information how you can participate in the production of this program or have suggestions and stories you'd like to hear about us, email us at info@mediasanctuary.org. And thank you. It's TPS, our engineer.